The following is a recording for development with the Israel Project on Tuesday, December 12, 2017, at 1 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have all of our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. I would now like to turn the conference over to Omri Sarin with the Israel Project. Sir, you may now begin.
Thank you for that. Thank you all for being here today, and thank you especially to our guest speaker, Ambassador Roth. As all of you know, the last week, President Trump announced that the U.S. is recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He announced that he's beginning a process to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That has generated both domestic and global, not just reactions, but a lot of confusion, and has put in motion a lot of things that were sort of that people were in wait-and-see mode on. To walk us through a lot of that, we have with us today Ambassador Dennis Ross. He is the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also a counselor there. As all of you know, he's one of America's most distinguished diplomats. He worked for Republican and Democratic administrations for decades. He was the point man on the peace process for Presidents H.W. Bush and Clinton. He spent 2 years as a special assistant to President Obama at the NSC, and, of course, a year as special advisor to Secretary Clinton. His most recent book that touches on a lot of these issues is Doomed to Succeed. It discusses the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship, going back to Truman and all the way through President Obama. He will give opening remarks, and then we'll go to Q&A for questions and answers. Please submit your questions as we go along to info@theisraelproject.org, info@theisraelproject.org. We already got a bunch of questions beforehand, so I will attempt to merge them and make sure that as many questions as possible get covered. Again, that's events at theisraelproject.org. I'm being yelled at for giving the wrong address. Events@theisraelproject.org. On that note, I will turn things over to Ambassador Ross.
Okay, thank you. Well, let me just quickly create a context for our discussion. What President Trump did last week was actually, interesting enough, exercise the waiver. The waiver is in the legislation that was adopted in 1995 that mandated the moving of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The legislation took place in an atmosphere immediately after, I should say, in an atmosphere that was probably the high point of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. It was adopted not long after the interim agreement, which brought the Palestinian Authority not only to Gaza and Jericho where it had been, but to the rest of the cities of the West Bank. The legislation was adopted by, the sponsors were Joe Lieberman and Robert Dole. Dole was running for the presidency at that time. The administration, Clinton administration, largely because of Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin had come to me, I was our negotiator then, and said, he had fought for Jerusalem, he had been born in Jerusalem, Jerusalem was in his blood, he wanted to see the embassy there. He couldn't and wouldn't ever oppose that, but he felt the timing of moving the embassy was not good because he said it would undercut King Hussein and it would undercut Arafat at a time when if we were going to actually see permanent status negotiations and agreements reached, they needed more political space, not less. So he wasn't going to do anything, and he couldn't do anything, but he wanted us to manage this so that it wouldn't become a problem or disruptive. And as I said, what he seemed to be more focused on than anything else at the time was seeing this as being quite disruptive to Hussein and Arafat in a way that would have put them very much on the defensive. So what we did is we worked to have a waiver put into the legislation which would allow the administration to waive for national security reasons without, and this was a very general national security waiver, waive for national security reasons not moving the embassy until such time as, in fact, it was okay to do so in the eyes of the administration. Now, every administration, including the Trump administration, exercised that waiver every 6 months. Clinton did it, Bush 43 did it, Obama did it, and now President Trump has done it twice. Now, the second time he did it, which was last week, he did it by creating a very different context. And the context was that he was recognizing the reality that Jerusalem is and will always be Israel's capital. What he wasn't doing when he recognized that reality was defining exactly what the outcome of permanent status would be for Jerusalem. He wasn't doing, as he said in his own words, he wasn't defining where Israeli sovereignty in the city would extend. That, he said, had to be determined only by negotiations. Now, that latter point didn't tend to penetrate too much into the Arab world because the headline of declaring Israel the capital, declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel, seemed to take up all the political space and gather all the political attention. In my mind, what the president did was actually something long overdue. Peacemaking in the Middle East is never going to become a reality until everyone adjusts to reality. One of the hardest things in this process has always been the kind of denial of reality. Well, one thing is very clear. Some significant part of Jerusalem is always going to be Israel's capital. They declared that. They declared Jerusalem in 1949 to be their capital. The reason the Truman administration didn't recognize it then was because in the original partition plan from November 29, 1947, which partitioned Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state, but it also made Jerusalem corpus separatum, meaning it gave it a separate legal status and wanted to treat it as a kind of international city. The Truman administration, even though it recognized Israel when it declared itself, it did not choose to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, even though it was declared as such, as I said, in February. Every administration since that sort of preserved that posture. Now, certain things changed. First with the Camp David Accords in September 1978, and then with the Declaration of Principles in September of 1993, you had Jerusalem treated as one of the permanent status issues. So the administrations since the legislation, even before the legislation, made it clear that they were not going to do anything on the embassy because they didn't want to look like they were prejudging the permanent status negotiations. The interesting thing is, if you look at the Arab Peace Initiative, the Arab Peace Initiative offers full peace and full diplomatic relations with the Israelis, including exchange of embassies, in return for Israel accepting the June 4, 1967 lines. Now, Israel is not going to accept the June 4, 1967 lines. Clearly, borders will reflect some kind of an adjustment from that. But even the June 4, 1967 lines mean that all of West Jerusalem is a part of Israel. So even in the Arab Peace Initiative, there is an acceptance of the reality, at least implicitly, that West Jerusalem will always be a part of Israel. All the president has done, in effect, is to make it clear that he's recognizing that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. He's not defining where that will be. That's being left to the negotiations. And that, it seems to me, is appropriate. My problem with what the president did had nothing to do with what he did. It was more how it was done. Because this is such a sensitive issue for the other side, because there is a desire to bring the Arab states into the process of making peace with the Palestinians, and there's a reason for that, because A, they can offer things to Israel in return for steps that Israel is taking vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and they can also create a cover for the Palestinians. But if you want to bring the Saudis and others in, it's important not to put them on the defensive on an issue like Jerusalem, where the Iranians were and are trying to exploit it right now. Hezbollah organized a huge demonstration in Lebanon yesterday. Hamas is out there. All of them are trying to indicate that somehow Jerusalem has been surrendered and Arab claims and Arab interests and Arab needs have been given up. Well, they haven't been. But had the president, after he exercised the waiver the first time, had he gone quietly to each of the Arab leaders, including Abu Mazen, King Salman, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah of Jordan, President Sisi of Egypt, had he gone quietly and said, I'm going to do this, but I don't want to do this in a way that makes it more difficult for you. So let's talk about the kind of things I could say when I do this that would minimize your difficulties and not put you on the defensive and preserve the political space you'll need to be able to respond to anything we may present in terms of trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And that, again, raises this interesting question of the timing. A week ago Sunday, Jared Kushner announced publicly that the administration is going to present a plan on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to try to resolve it. And he said it would be on the big issues, not the small issues. So, in a sense, before you present such a plan, it would be important for the administration to be looking for ways to expand the political space of those on all sides, not to decrease it. Now, certainly, this has expanded the political space on the Israeli side with this decision, because this is something embraced by all Israelis for completely understandable reasons. And again, it's a fact. You know, some significant part of Israel will always be, some significant part of Jerusalem will always be Israel's capital. That is a fact. And so recognizing that fact can be a good thing. Had the administration prepared the ground in advance, not by giving calls one day before to each of the Arab leaders, which necessarily put them in a position where they were bound to say no unless it would make them appear as if somehow they had conceded this. And so, again, to kind of wrap up this part of the discussion, I think what the president did was right. How it was done is something that I have a problem with, because I think actually it worked at cross purposes with what the administration itself is hoping to be able to achieve. And I do think right now, given the kind of defensive posture that the different Arab leaders have been put in, this can be rescued, but it will require the administration emphasizing repeatedly that permanent status negotiations have not been preempted, and have not been prejudged. And that Palestinian claims and Palestinian needs and Arab claims and needs in Jerusalem will be addressed in the negotiations, and they too have not been precluded or preempted. So I think the more it can say that, within a couple of months' time, perhaps, the atmosphere will change and the plan can be presented. Right now, I think if the plan were to be presented in the next couple of weeks, it would almost certainly draw a negative response from the Arabs and from the Palestinians. That doesn't have to be the way it will be if the plan that's presented in a few months' time is one that is perceived as being credible. If it's credible, it becomes a lot easier to make the case that everybody has to respond to it and not to use an excuse not to respond to it. So why don't I stop there and we can have a discussion.
Thank you for that. And as a reminder, you can kick over questions to events@theisraelproject.org, events@theisraelproject.org. We've got about another 15 minutes, so we'll take questions as they come in. Ambassador, the questions that we got overwhelmingly before, in the ramp-up to this call was, you've touched on it, but I was hoping to get a little more specific about it. What is the appetite on the Palestinian side for a peace deal? Whether it's rolled out, in 2 months, whether it's rolled out in 6 months, whether it's rolled out next week. Both before the announcement, where were they? After the announcement, where are they? And to what degree are we going to see that distance shrink as time goes on, where they get back to where they were?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, interestingly enough, the Palestinians before the announcement, they had this perception of President Trump that he was unpredictable, but because he was unpredictable, he might well be much more responsive to their needs than people thought. So they were waiting with almost a kind of enthusiasm for him to come with his plan, the plan that's being developed by Kushner and Greenblatt, now, obviously, they are saying, you know, that we can't, that the U.S. can't be a mediator because we have we've made that impossible. We've preempted the negotiations, which we haven't done. But that's where they are. The essence of your question, though, is how ready are they to make peace? And the answer is, we haven't seen them adopt positions that would suggest that it's easy for them to make peace and to suddenly be prepared to rationalize the kind of compromises that will be necessary on their side. Look, both sides are going to have to take on history and mythology. Both sides, therefore, are going to have to make excruciating decisions if you're really going to have a peace between the two. We've not seen anything from the Palestinians that suggests they're ready for that. And yet I think, you know, the whole approach of outside in, the idea of outside in was not that the Arab states will make peace with Israel in place of the Palestinians and therefore the Palestinians will have no choice but to make peace. The real concept of outside in was that Palestinians on their own have never really rationalized compromise and can't because they see themselves as a weaker player, because they see themselves having suffered a grave injustice. They can't on their own compromise. The onus is always on the other side. It's always on Israel to act. So if you're going to get the Palestinians to go along and make these kinds of decisions, they need an Arab cover for it. They need the Arabs to help assume responsibility for it. They need to be able to explain, look, you know, our Arab brethren put us in a position where we really don't have a choice except to go along. So you really, it's in some ways, the premise of the question is built around an assumption that the Palestinians are responding. I think the key is understanding the Palestinians are not prone to respond unless you create a context where the Arab states are helping to absorb a lot of the responsibility for the difficult decisions on their side. And therefore, the real issue here is how has the declaration affected the prospect of the leading Arab states being prepared to play that kind of a role? I don't think it has ended that prospect, but I think it's in the near term, it makes it more difficult for them to act on it. That's why I think you have to create some time and space between now what's been done and the time that the plan would be presented.
Thank you for that. As a reminder, we're on the record. Ambassador Ross's comments can be used, and if you have follow-up, you can always ping us at the Israel Project. Next question, or next set of questions, Ambassador, and you know, we get into this every time you're kind enough to do one of these conference calls for us, which is, for decades, the line has been that everybody knows what the final status will roughly look like. The question is getting the parties to that place. We ask this question every time, whether there's any appetite for alternatives, one state, three states, confederation, one state plus Palestinian civil rights, limited demilitarization, or are we still in a place where the bulk of the Arab world and the bulk of the Israeli foreign policy establishment, as well as, you know, the feelings back here at home, are that it's going to be roughly two states, roughly along the 67 line, some division of Jerusalem, and so on?
Well, I guess I would put it this way. The first, for those who think there's a one-state alternative, whether they're among Palestinians or they're among the right wing within Israel, a one-state outcome, even though their two perspectives are quite different on what it would mean, a one-state outcome means that you're taking two national identities and you're putting them in one state. And then when you look at the Middle East and you look at wherever there's more than one identity, you seem to see states that are in conflict and turmoil. One state, I think, given the realities of the Middle East, and I start off by saying, you know, peacemaking depends upon adapting to reality and accepting or understanding the reality, not denying it. One state is a prescription for an enduring conflict, and we shouldn't, that's the last thing we should wish for. What we need, because there's two national movements, two national identities, we need two states for two peoples. And I don't see an alternative to that, because any alternative to that is basically a variation on the one-state outcome. And a one-state outcome just means that you're going to have an endless conflict. The terms, look, without getting into the specifics of the terms, there is no agreement if you don't address the needs of both sides. So the Israeli needs have to be addressed, but so do the Palestinian needs. You know, what I was saying about the declaration that President Trump made, he was very clear in terms of saying that the boundaries of where Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem will be is something to be negotiated. That implicitly says that there obviously are Palestinian claims, and they have to be on the table. If you're going to have peace on each of these core issues, what the borders are, what Jerusalem is, what the refugees are, the settlements, security, everything has to be done in a way that meets the needs of both sides. Now, obviously, it's not easy to reconcile the needs of both sides. But you go through and you look at what is absolutely necessary. What's absolutely necessary for the Israelis is security and security arrangements that ensure that Israel can defend itself by itself. What's absolutely necessary for the Palestinians is that they have a state, and the state is one that can be viable, and the state is one that can be independent. So that, at the highest level, is what you're going to have to reconcile. Underneath that, then you have to sort out, well, what is the final status of Jerusalem going to look like? Clearly, with an issue like refugees, if you go back to the Bush-Sharon letter of April 14, 2004, that letter said that the refugee issue should be resolved by the Palestinian refugees returning to their state, not to Israel. If you go back to the Clinton parameters, we were creating a very significant compensation fund for those who, if they chose to stay where they were, if they chose to go back to the Palestinian state, they would be, they would be compensated. If they went to a third country, there would be a compensation for them. So each of these issues has to take account of the needs of each side. In some cases, what's required on one side takes precedence on one issue over the other, but if it takes precedence on one issue, then it means on other issues that the other side gains some kind of precedence. There obviously is a need to reconcile what each side has to live with. This is, when you make peace, it's not about reconciling wants, it's about reconciling needs. Ultimately, any agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians for two states for two peoples has to take all that into account, and we'll see with the plan that is going to be presented by the administration what it looks like.
We're running low on time, so I'll try to bundle two questions into one. Traditionally, when we get to this point of conversation, we ask about the role of the role played by lack of Palestinian institutions, whether it be political, economic, and so on, but overarchingly sovereignty, which is to say Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank seem to preclude a two-state solution. There have been talks of unity governments. They've gotten farther in some cases, not as far in other cases as previously. Can you speak to Hamas's ability specifically to play the role of a spoiler this time around? And in that context, also the ability of regional players to mitigate Hamas's ability to play a spoiler this time around?
Well, Hamas will play a spoiler role, and you're already seeing it in terms of their reaction to the declaration. There have been some rockets now fired into Israel. Israel holds Hamas responsible for anything that comes out of Gaza. I think the reconciliation agreement, which by my count is, I think, the 10th one, may or may not go forward. We'll see. And part of the problem with the reconciliation agreement is that the Hamas wants the PA to come in and assume all the responsibility for governance, which means pick up all the day-to-day responsibilities where there's profound dissatisfaction for reasons that, you have 4 to 6 hours a day of electricity within Gaza. One of the things that Abu Mazen has not yet done is he continues not to pay the Israelis for the electricity that they previously were supplying to Gaza. Once you stop those payments and the Israelis stop providing electricity. Now, it wasn't going to make it 24 hours a day of electricity, but it was going to make, instead of 4 to 6 hours a day, more closer to 10 hours a day of electricity, which would make life easier in what is otherwise quite difficult within Gaza. He holds that back because he's trying to use it as a lever on them for them to give up their arms, which they won't give up. So it's hard to see, you know, let me put it this way, that there is a, Hamas has an interest in trying to have the reconciliation go forward, but it wants to do it in a way without giving up its arms. Abu Mazen has an interest in wanting to go forward because both understand that the Palestinian public wants this to take place. They hate the idea that that there's a, this kind of a division among Palestinians. They see it only as weakening what is already the reality is they're the weakest party. So, you know, will Hamas continue to play a spoiler role? So long as they're not prepared to really make adjustments towards the PA with regard to the weapons, and so long as they are, their aim is to resist anything that looks like peace, then you're, you know, it's hard to see them playing anything but a spoiler role. If they were to begin to adjust those positions, you know, then you might be in a different place, but we haven't seen much indication that they're ready to do that. Can they be affected by other countries? Yes, they can be affected clearly by Egypt. One of the reasons that Hamas moved the way it did in terms of allowing the PA to come back into the border crossings, in terms of wanting there to be a process where the PA comes back in and basically is responsible for governance in Gaza, was in no small part not just a function of the conditions in Gaza, but also a function of wanting to be responsive to Egypt. Egypt, everyone focuses on Israel keeping Gaza under a kind of embargo, but Israel allows about 1,000 trucks a day into Gaza. Egypt, at Rafah, keeps the border closed most of the time. And if there's going to be an outlet, you know, the Rafah crossing point into Egypt could certainly be something that eases the pressure on life within Gaza. And that's one of the reasons that I think that Hamas was prepared to look more towards Egypt, less towards Turkey, less towards Qatar. And again, the extent to which Egypt can affect Hamas's behavior could be a positive and could get at the essence of what you're asking, which is who could take steps among the Arab states that would affect the Hamas instinct and impulse towards spoiling.
Thank you. That last question, and then after that, if anybody needs to contact Ambassador Russ, please go ahead and hit us up at events@theisraelproject.org, and we will pass on contact info for the Washington Institute. We've gotten a bunch of questions, all asking in different ways. Okay, Trump went out of his way to say that the declaration does not prejudice final status talks. The Arab world, for all that it was not consulted and wasn't looped in, has been, you know, read out on a bunch of peace process progress and Kushner's tried to make them a partner and so on. What is the source of unrest, not just in the Arab world, but also in Europe and to a certain extent even in Canada, that if the decision does seem to be on its merits, limited, and in as much as the administration has been engaging Arab partners, where is it coming from, and how long can it be expected to last?
Well, I mean, again, on a big issue, when you give basically one day's notice, I've often said about diplomacy, when you engage in surprise, surprise always drives others into their most defensive positions. And this is an issue. You're taking what is the most emotional, emotive issue between the Israelis and Palestinians, and it involves the Arabs as well, given the holy sites, their holy sites, the Muslim holy sites, but also, at least for some of the Christian Arabs, the Christian sites as well. You are taking what is the most emotional issue. You're taking what is the one of the most issues that are most central between the Israelis and Palestinians, and you're not preparing the ground. You're not giving anybody a chance to adjust. You're not allowing them to prepare the ground or prepare their own publics. So I think that helps to account. So I said I did not have a problem with what the president did. I had a problem with how it was done. And I just think it made it more difficult for what the administration itself is trying to do. Now, that helps to explain the reaction in the Arab world, because no one wants to look like they're conceding their interests in Jerusalem, number one. And especially at a time when all of the radical Islamists will seize upon this to use it as a club to beat them over the head with, which is exactly what you've seen. You've seen what Hezbollah, what Nasrallah is saying. You've seen what Rouhani said in Iran. You've seen what Hamas is saying. They're all trying to seize this as an issue that can mobilize support for them against those who actually are the American partners. So I think that explains the reactions in the Arab world, although, to be fair, again, you know, we've seen some violence, but it's not nearly what some were predicting. And that says something also, I think, about there's a general fatigue. And, you know, precisely because this actually didn't touch the holy site. So if you look at what happened over the summer when the Israelis introduced magnetometers after two border policemen were killed by guns that were smuggled in, Israel in the end backed off of that. Because that, you know, that was seen as mobilizing great passions, because it seemed to be changing the status quo and limiting access into the Haram al-Sharif. And so I think, you know, because this didn't directly touch the holy site, because there's a fatigue, I'm not saying there obviously hasn't been a backlash and a reaction, there has been, but it's not what many were predicting would be the case. And so I think it's important to take account of that as well. It's why I think, even though there is a defensiveness right now on the part of some of our key Arab partners, clearly in public, and that won't go away overnight, I do think if the administration presents something that is a credible plan, they then have an opportunity to respond to that. Now, the Europeans, I think, you know, they see this as one more unilateral step by the administration. They weren't happy with the non-certification of the JCPOA. They weren't happy with the walking away from the Paris Climate Accord. So anything that looks once again like it's a unilateral American move that doesn't seem to take their concerns into account, they're going to react negatively to. And I think that's what we're seeing.
And on that note, thank you again, Ambassador. Anybody who has more questions, feel free to ping us at events@theisraelproject.org. And thank you for everybody for your time today.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.